Welcome to Hot Plate, a post-foodie podcast. I'm your host, Mirella Amato. Today on Hot Plate, we examine ordering chèvre, the carbon footprint of anchovies, where tomato juice tastes best, and cow tech innovations. Hello, Joshna.
Hello.
It's episode four.
Episode four. Season two, episode four. That's very exciting. We've really settled into life happily here in our new frequency home.
That's right. It is cozy.
Things are good.
So I wanted to talk to you today. There was a bit of a kerfuffle in the beer world.
Yes.
And it reminded me of a pet peeve I had in the food world.
Okay.
So what happened in the beer world is this gentleman in the UK wrote an article about how in beer we use foreign terms for things that actually have a name in English. So
okay.
He named a couple of them. One of them I remember is Förder, which is essentially a large vat. Like think of like a barrel,
yeah.
But if it was, you know, as big as a building.
Oh, so okay.
It's a large wooden
those
vat.
Things, I got it.
Yes. So the Förder is a term that comes to us from the Belgian brewing tradition. And when we're brewing Belgian style, I guess it's just sexier to use the Belgian term.
Yes.
And his whole thing was, you know, why are we being like this? It's a vat. Let's just call it a vat.
Yes, yes, yes.
And this reminded me.
Tell me.
Of how much I get annoyed every time I read a menu and I see the word chèvre.
Right. Instead,
you just want
goat cheese. You want it to just say goat cheese.
Why are you calling it chèvre?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I understand this. Tell me more about the peeve. Tell me more about the pet peeve.
It bothers me that so the ones that immediately come to mind, the two that
irk
me are chèvre and charcuterie. Which should be charcuterie.
Right.
It bothers me because they're cold cuts. And I ended up in this long debate with someone about, oh, well, if we have to distinguish them from cold cuts. Because when you say cold cuts, you think bologna
and
things
sort
like
of
that.
Mass-produced thing.
And when I think cold cuts, I think salami, prosciutto. Those are the cold cuts that I grew up with. First of all, and second of all, if you're going to bring that argument, then we need to come up with a new word for a burger, for anything that isn't made, you know, that isn't an actual beef patty. We need to come up with a new word for pizza.
Yep.
I'm sorry, like we need to come up with a new word for, you know, numerous types of Chinese foods and different things where we're not creating
the
other.
This, like,
that's not a good argument.
Thing happening that
and
is, yeah.
For me, I guess it just smacks of a kind of elitism and a kind of, I just don't, it's, you know.
And pretense.
I speak French. I see chèvre on a menu. I know where you're coming from, right? But, you know, a lot of people might not know what that word means. Where if you said goat cheese, they would know exactly what that meant. So it's like, why are we creating this space? And interestingly, they're all French words. I just was curious to know, do you know why this happens? What are your thoughts on?
So
has it ever bothered you?
Well, this troubles me. I don't really know where to land on this. Right? Because because I cannot deny that there is like a sort of window dressing or pretense involved in some of this, right? It is to make something sound fancier than it perhaps really is, or people may understand it to be. And definitely it is the kind of practice that you see when people are writing menus.
Yes.
People want to be intentionally as impressive as possible and let you know how hardcore and French their kitchen is.
Okay.
Right? That is for sure a thing that's happening. Now, it seems to me that this really hinges on the idea about not doing this when there is already an English word for it.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? That seems, because in my mind, I thought we can go anywhere with, because I was thinking about aloo mutter, for example, right? Aloo mutter is an Indian dish. Aloo mutter is a Hindi word.
Yeah.
But truthfully, the translation of aloo mutter is literally just potatoes and peas.
Okay, but isn't it potatoes and peas prepared in a specific way?
No.
No? It's just
potatoes and peas? Potatoes and peas. Aloo is potato, mutter is peas.
Okay.
Right? So technically in this context, there is an English word for it.
Okay.
But if I said to you potato and peas, saying potato and peas is different than saying aloo mutter. because alu matar is the name of the dish, you know, is the name of the dish of the prepared thing with the seasonings.
Right,
and
but
all
that's
the
with the but that's with the it the preparation.
Yes.
So alu matar does not imply that I'm just going to get potatoes and peas on
it
my
doesn't.
Plate. It's the full round.
Dish.
Whereas chèvre is just goat cheese.
It's just goat cheese.
Right?
But
like,
okay,
for example,
yeah.
you know, words like prosciutto doesn't bother me. It's a very specific item. Or pho. You know, those are foreign
yeah.
words, but they point to very specific things. These, and I think that those are the only three that
yeah.
the charcuterie, chèvre, and courgette are the only three that are commonly used where there is an English, although zucchini's not a, well, it is an English word now.
I was
going to
say,
but,
because the Brits use courgette.
Do they?
The Brits use courgette and aubergine instead of eggplant and zucchini.
Okay.
As the sign in the grocery store says,
okay.
courgettes.
Then I'll let that one slide. That was the least egregious for me.
And anyway. Then, okay, now let's talk about the chef.
Yes.
Because I see what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are now three or four different kinds of cheese made from the milk from goats.
Okay.
That's not all that soft log. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And so the question I'm going to ask is chèvre, when they say chèvre, then you know that it is that goat cheese
the soft
as opposed
log.
To other cheese. Cause there's plenty, there's goat cheddar. I've had goat feta there. You know what I mean? Goat's milk finds its way, into other things.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding that I really do. I see the pretense. You know what I
yeah.
mean? I see the
yeah.
reason to roll your eyes
at
this,
one.
Right? But at the same time, for the purposes of communication and letting somebody know exactly what's in there,
yeah.
I want to roll down. I want to chew this around a little bit because what would be, where's accuracy, where's being concise,
mm-hmm.
being as concise as possible. Chèvre is one word, goat cheese is two words. In a, you know, the real estate of a menu, I just don't know where to draw the line. Right,
it's,
I see. The
I understand
need
that it's a tough one
to pull the reins back, but I don't know where to draw the line.
And I'll fully admit that this falls under pet peeve for me.
Right,
so there's
right,
it's right. there's an emotional piece to
yes.
it. You know, I come from a position of privilege because I do speak French, so it's not an issue for me. But it does grate me.
So ideally,
mm-hmm.
in following this logic. What would you have the menu say that is the advertisement for that wooden board full of all of the house-cured meats and cheeses?
House-cured meat and cheeses would be great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds...
I love it.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Because the other thing is a lot of these things are difficult to pronounce, too.
Yes.
Right? Like, why are you asking someone to say charcuterie when they could be saying, I'll have
house
a...
Made.
Yeah, your,
house-cured,
your house-cured
right.
meats. I've even gotten... We're going on a tangent.
Okay,
now,
amazing. Bring it.
But I have had more than one barista get upset with me because I asked for a cafe latte and I should be saying latte.
What?
More than one.
For God's sake.
And so now we're getting on a tangent,
yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
and then the whole like amuse. It's an amuse bouche. It's not an amuse. You know, we're getting into like if you want to get snobby.
Yeah.
I'll get snobby, right? But this is not the, I'm going
yes.
on a tangent here. But, the point is it when it's not necessary.
About the notion that we are living in a technically bilingual country.
Ideally bilingual country.
Yeah. And I realize that that's a sort of isolationist approach because it's not thorough, you know, the French is not thoroughly incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the idea that the French lives with the, you know what I mean? That especially here in Canada, I am not, you know.
Yeah.
One way to be like, maybe we all just know that this is what it is and we can just use these French words. I'm not sure. It's a tricky one.
I hear
one.
What you're saying. I don't think these people are writing charcuterie on their menu to make
to
the
promote
Québécois
national,
feel welcome.
The national inclusion of both of our
make
official languages.
Well.
A girl can dream.
So Joshna. What's next?
What's next is we're going to talk about climate change diets.
Ooh.
Right? It's interesting. I've seen it
so
pop up a lot.
Eating based on climate change?
Yes.
Concerns?
Eating based on perhaps lowest carbon footprint or even thinking about mitigating climate change, but eating with the issue of climate change as your focus. Right. And as you can imagine, there's lots and lots of tips, local food, you know, obviously distance to production and consumption are probably at the top of this list.
Right.
Right. And there was a piece that I shared around from the New York Times with advice about what a climate diet could look like. Mm-hmm. Right. And we'll, there's lots to talk about there with actually with the, what the content is.
Yeah.
And the activist inside of me thinks it is amazing that we like it's about time we started having these considerations in where how we made our decision about what we eat. Right.
For sure.
The white cord strawberries and the smoothies and the banana, you know, all these things are like these are just things that we want. But should we actually be having them? What does the how does the planet need us to eat?
What is the impact?
Right. And the thing that I really felt quite compelled by was that it's the first time we're really seeing the notion of a diet or a diet plan that actually is about benefiting someone or something other than yourself.
Right. Because when we think of benefiting the planet, often I think of, you know, making sure that I have my cloth grocery bags
and, you know,
the straws and the packaging. So it's all, you know, what's around the food.
Yes.
But this to me is a new conversation. The idea of actually choosing your food based on the environment.
Yes. And have the priority about essentially it's about production, distribution and waste management of what you eat.
Yes.
Right. That's essentially what this is all about. It's like, where is it coming from? How is it produced? And then what happens once you're done with it?
I didn't get that so much from the article, though. So tell me your approach on climate change, because I love the idea. But this person's article, I was not very happy with.
Right. So I mean, the way
with what climate change diet should look.
Yeah. Like. The way I would advocate climate change eating would be to really consider really considering the ingredients in the food that you are eating, right? Be it from a restaurant or a grocery store or even the farmer's market, right? To really think about where it's come from, how it was grown, and then how waste is managed for the thing.
Like how far it's traveled, has it had to fly over?
Right. And what has to happen is it a landfill for packaging? Is it housed in things that won't ever break down? This is the kind of stuff that we have to start considering.
Maybe how much waste will be created from the food, you know, if you have to peel a lot off.
That's it. If there's lots of like outer sheets of things or whatever else it is, to really consider every stage of that process. And I will say that I do understand that that is perhaps more involved than is being suggested in most other places.
It is. And I think what I do appreciate about the article was that it was trying to stay approachable because, you know, what you're talking about, I think, requires a certain amount of food literacy.
Definitely. And commitment.
And
yes,
one of the things I loved in this article, which I don't understand why it's still a thing, is bottled water.
I know.
Why are people paying for bottles of water when they're already paying for the water that's coming out of the tap?
This is it.
And bottled water is not regulated in any way. It could just be tap water that you're paying for, except for...
And often is.
It's been... The plastic is leached into it now.
Exactly.
And so it's a little more toxic and, you know, the landfills.
Yeah.
So that part I really liked. And then in this article, he went on to say in terms of meat eating, you want to stick to chicken and fish.
Yes.
And I think it's common sense that if climate change is your concern, then I would say that's a pretty valid reason to go vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
Like that for me is, you know, the best way if you're eating just local vegetables and fruit and so on. And
the least impactful
way. That being said, and, I think our listeners already know this. I'm not a huge advocate of vegetarianism. Mm-hmm. I think meat in moderation is an equally valid approach.
I do.
And there's certainly a lot of evidence that shows that chicken, in terms of carbon footprint, is much better than, for example, beef. So that was great. Where I got stuck was the fish.
Yes.
And
of course.
I got initially just stuck because my back went up because I've noticed this pattern that every single article you read, whether it's the best climate change diet, the best weight loss diet, the best diet for, I don't know, athleticism, for this, for that, it always, always comes down to chicken and fish.
It does.
And it's like the idea is the world has just decided that chicken and fish are good and that other meats are evil. And so everything needs to come down to that.
Yes.
So that was my initial instinct, but I thought, you know what? Maybe he's right. Maybe fish is great.
Mm.
No.
No.
It is not. So,
yes.
So as I got digging.
Let's see it. Let's hear it.
I got into the fine print of it.
Yeah.
And yes, some fish
mm-hmm.
is very low carbon footprint. And the biggest source of the carbon footprint for fish, if you think about it, it's totally logical, is how much the boat has to zip around to,
yes,
to catch it,
course.
Right? And so the fish that are really low carbon footprint are the tiny, tiny ones. So anchovies and herrings.
Okay.
So I'm sorry, in this article, when he said eat chicken and fish, I'm sure he was, you know.
He was not talking about.
No one's reading that thinking, I'm going to have anchovies. Yeah, no.
You are right.
So when you get into most other types of fish, the carbon footprint is actually equal or higher to pork.
Yes.
Which, of course, is one of the quote-unquote evil meats.
Yeah.
It's not on top, actually. Pork is quite a bit lower than beef, but fish is higher than pork. So why didn't you mention pork in this article? Because mm-hmm. it's one of the bad meats, right? And I understand that the carbon footprint might not necessarily be the biggest issue when you're talking about the oceans, but the truth is we have completely pillaged the oceans.
Yes.
The populations are thinning.
Mm-hmm.
And what they have proven is that these thinning populations are a lot more susceptible and reactive to climate change because they're not as robust.
And the resilience is not there. Sure.
The resilience is not there. So I don't know. I just got very upset with this whole fish piece.
Yeah, well, I think it's a really important piece because the thing that shows up here, which I see a lot too, and to your point, is that this is all standing on the industrial food system, right? It's about industrial production practices,
mm-hmm.
right? But I would love to see what those numbers are in terms of footprint around natural raising. I mean, you know, natural raising of meat, and is it, how does that change?
Right.
You know, when we rethink wild caught fish versus, pasture raised cows and chickens, how does that change when we're not talking about feedlots?
Right. And the other really interesting piece that came up in this article is it also depends on what you're feeding.
What they're eating.
What they're eating is the biggest piece because in my mind, I was thinking maybe farmed fish would be a lot better than wild fish.
Mm-hmm.
But no, because we have to go through such an effort to collect everything that they eat. So
it's madness.
It's tricky, but my back just went up because I feel like people want a carte blanche to eat fish because it's got, you know, high omegas and they, you know, it's quote unquote lean cuisine
or
whatever.
Solution. Yes.
And the fact that this article in a major newspaper
mm-hmm.
was making that concession, which was really like not accurate at all. You know,
not at all.
He could have said anchovies.
Exactly.
If he wanted to, to be real.
And to give us the truth about what climate eating actually is
about.
That's
right.
Right?
That's right.
Thanks for that. I like the Morella dig on that one. It was important. But I'm going to start thinking about how we actually make this transition because it feels like a really important bit to consider.
A great first step is packaging for me.
Yes.
I mean, plastic is horrible on every account, climate change and otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyone who's looking for like a solid first steps, ditch the water bottles.
Yes.
And, you know, minimal packaging.
And
take your bags. It's a wonderful start.
All right. I like that a lot.
I came across a really interesting article, and the idea of the article was, you know, which drinks should you order when you're in flight?
Oh, right. Okay.
Based on how our senses are muted or affected
mm-hmm.
in flight. But I find it interesting, you know, beyond the drink aspect to just really think about how much our senses are impacted.
And what an altered environment it really is up there. Yeah.
Right. Because we all think of, you know, the dryness and the low pressure
mm-hmm.
up there. And so they've done scientific research and it reduces our sensitivity to sweet and salty
mm-hmm.
foods. So those two disappear. But the other piece that I thought was really interesting, and this is all airlines doing these studies.
Yes.
Right? Because they're trying to make their food taste good.
Yes.
I guess they're doing their best.
Yes, they're doing their best.
Is the noise. And
that was really
shown,
interesting.
Yeah.
I was really curious about that too.
So they've done tests, and if you're in a super noisy environment, they replicate the exact noise volume of a plane. There are some things that you just can't taste as well. But then, interestingly, there are some seasonings that you can taste a lot more intensely.
More intensely.
And I thought you'd be interested in this list.
What's
cardamom, lemongrass, and curry.
Oh.
Three flavors I have never had on a flight.
Exactly.
I'm just gonna say.
I have that virtue of the fact that I've flown to India a few times.
Oh, yeah?
Right? And some of those menus. And I took a trip to Southeast Asia, and so some lemongrass did show up. And now that you say it, I remember thinking to myself, oh, someone's really investing in the cuisine up here with these more thoughtful, interesting flavors. It is because they work.
It's the science.
I love that.
So drinks-wise, of course, they talk about, since your sense of sweetness is a little bit dulled,
yes,
that you can aim for a sweeter wine and maybe something that's less bitter or less acidic, because those two senses aren't dulled.
Yep.
So that'll give you more an illusion of balance. Interestingly, they talked about Riesling.
Oh, yeah.
And then they also mentioned it's a wine that's never on flights. So I guess their science experiments are limited to the food on the airlines, and they're not thinking as far.
Yes, and they're not thinking. It's true. Because Riesling would actually be probably a pretty smart choice, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's funny.
And then for the beer, which I call drinks.
Indeed. Indeed.
For the beer, they obviously, for the same reason, said steer clear of IPAs,
yes,
which are all bitterness.
No IPAs in the air.
And
I like
unless
that.
You just love that bitterness, in which case you'll get overload.
It's cranked, yeah.
Right? But one really interesting thing that came up is that umami is actually enhanced by loud background noise. And then they talked about...
wild.
I know.
Wow. Okay.
And so these drink specialists were talking about bringing roasted peas on the plane as a snack to really enhance the drinking experience.
Oh, that is amazing.
But the other thing that's really rich in umami is... tomato juice.
Here we go.
And
I like this.
In the article, they mentioned that people tend to order more tomato juice in the air, and it hit me. That's the only time I drink tomato juice is in flight, and I do it all the time.
Yes, I do too. I do too, and I had the same response. I was like, bing, triggered by this tomato juice conversation, and then I thought, in light of the piece that you had shared, I'm like, I need to revisit this tomato juice conversation to figure out how that fits all into this now new knowledge that we have.
Tell me more.
Right? So I did some digging on my own.
Ooh,
and I found some fascinating stuff. First of all, I found some you know, lab academic science proven information about why tomato juice is such a popular airline beverage.
Okay.
Right? And one of the things that I loved is that... there are a couple of things people talked about. One is that because of our dulled taste buds, the dullness around the sweet and the salty, the inherent sweetness and saltiness becomes manageable.
Okay.
Right? It balances out. And the altitude it removes that sort of heavy muddiness that also comes with tomato juice.
So it's more than the umami.
It is more than the umami is part of it.
Every aspect.
But the truth is, it really appears as though tomato juice becomes a whole other thing in the air.
Wow.
Right? And our relationship to it is a much more palatable, enjoyable thing because it is meeting us where we are in this sort of compromised state, 30,000 feet in the air.
And I think there is also something to be said about that pulpier texture in a dry environment.
Yes.
It's, I guess, more pleasing.
Precisely. I think that was actually mentioned. And then the last curious bit was that with trimming costs and budgets and whatever it is, a glass or a can of tomato juice is a bit of a meal in a can.
Right.
Right? It is one of the most sort of nutritionally dense, potentially nourishing things that is on that cart. That spins up in the aisle.
Also, it's vegetables, which is,
exactly,
a rare thing to find in the wild. So it's
precisely
good.
Now, just to make things interesting, the piece that I found was a story from 2018 about United Airlines.
Yes. Right?
They were attempting to trim some budgets, and they thought that they would, that one of the things they would do was narrow the inventory on those beverage carts.
Let me guess.
Right?
Who yes. drinks tomato juice?
Who? Nobody. Right? And so they decided to chuck the tomato juice, and there was like virtual bona fide revolution. Obviously this happened via social media.
What?
Customers are very quick to express their outrage. And so shortly after this happened, United Airlines posted on their Twitter feed, "You say tomato, we say we hear you. Tomato juice is here to stay. Hashtag let's call the whole thing off."
Let's call the whole thing
good
off.
Good on them, right?
Yeah.
And so the tomato juice is back on, and nobody's messing with it because we really understand that tomato juice works up in the air.
And we're not alone.
And we're not alone. It's all of us together.
It's a real
yes.
thing. And yeah. backed by science.
Okay, Mirella, you have brought the most adorable piece here. What's next?
So this story came to my attention. I heard it in passing on the radio and I thought, no way. It just seemed so unreal. And then I started snooping around. It was on many major news sources. It was repeated. And although there were some questions marked raised, no one has debunked it in any way. So I think it might be true.
I love it.
And the story is this.
It's insane. Yes.
In Moscow, there is a project that involves putting VR goggles on cows. So, you know, these would have been goggles that are especially designed for
right,
cow
because
heads.
The wider head,
and
of course.
Cow vision, which is apparently the different, they have a different spectrum of colors that they see. So they've designed these goggles.
Oh my God, of course.
That the goal of the goggles is to relax the cows so that they can produce better milk and more milk. And in the VR goggles, what they are seeing is just a sunny day in a lovely green pasture, which is, I guess, not their current environment.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a little gray out there.
I think you're right.
Oh, just the pictures of these cows.
The vision of the cow sort of mindlessly shooting its head around, trying to figure out what's up and down. It's a tremendous thing to watch. And when I read the piece that you sent over, I was like, this is the height of human madness.
Right.
It is just so accelerated because essentially the pasture is mm-hmm. actually the place that they're supposed to be standing.
Right.
It's only because they're being raised in this sort of industrial feedlot hooked up, especially for dairy cows. This is major, like cranked up to a machine for a lot of time. And I mean, maybe the machine's not the problem, but I thought, how amazing that because we've decided to intensify production on dairy and mm-hmm. cow dairy, that we are now, and the thought to just let them roam properly in some nature is not on the table.
I think some of them were actually roaming, but it just wasn't a luscious, green, gorgeous pasture.
Oh, that's fascinating.
It might have just been a more arid climate, right. A little bit grayer.
Not as dreamy. Yeah.
But this is a real thing. So relaxed and happy cows definitely produce better and more milk.
Yes.
And there's all kinds of, some people will play, send violinists out to play
yes.
some classical music to their cows.
Yes.
A lot of people massage their cows.
Conversations.
Yeah. All of which, though, are interactive mm-hmm. things, right? This VR goggles is the opposite of interacting.
Yes.
Right? It's isolating.
Completely.
Those cows.
And it feels like to me, it just feels nuts, right? Because
yeah.
I think that the piece that we're not connected to is that when this shift towards industrial dairy production happened, yields per cow would have dropped.
That makes sense.
You know
yeah.
what I mean? If we move from this sort of idyllic pastured scenario,
mm-hmm.
Which is interesting because a lot of the argument in defense of the factory farming is about increasing yields.
Yield, yep.
Right? The irony is not law, right?
Or efficiency,
so,
I guess.
Efficiency is the perfect word. So to realize that we are at a place now where the solution to this,
mm-hmm.
to these lower yields as a result of industrial production, because these poor cows, these ladies
yeah.
are stressed out.
not happy
in this other scenario, and that the solution is to put these goggles on them is extraordinary. These are the things that will go down in the books as like the height of particular human madness.
Also, I don't own VR goggles, but I imagine that custom design VR goggles for a cow would not be super cheap. So it makes me wonder about how much more value, or, you know, how much more milk are they producing? And is VR goggles really the most logical way to make these cows?
Is this the best use of the resources?
Maybe there is a lovely pasture nearby.
This is the thing. How about they just stand in some nice grass, maybe?
Unbelievable. This was released by the Ministry of Agriculture and Food in the Moscow region, this study, and they've said that it does look like it has an impact, but further studies are required. Mm. So
my favorite line was that that the life in the goggles helped to soften the mood.
I missed that one.
Which was the best.
If you're enjoying our podcast, please leave a rating or review. It helps others find us. Hot Plate is part of the Frequency Podcast Network. Original music by Dave Bell. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Hot Plate Pod. Follow me at Beerology on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And follow Joshna at Joshna Maharaj on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Hot Plate is produced by Mirella Amato, that's me, and Dennis Coyne. Thanks for listening.